Hello, here we are in episode 2 of the Nightlamp podcast.
Hello.
And Adela and I are sitting in Adela's cute little dining room, which is one of my favourite places because she brings me tea with little sugar cubes with tiny little tongs in a cute little tea set.
Yes, you like that, don't you, Stefan?
Yes, I do, thank you.
Yeah, it's doing it right. It's doing tea the right way.
Exactly. As we all know, I remember when we first had you on board a couple of months ago, Adela, your first request was that I buy saucers.
Absolutely. You cannot have tea cups with no saucers. I was scandalised.
Did you think it was going to be barbaric?
Well, it was barbaric, but now you do have sauces and everything is fine.
I'm so happy we're civilised.
Yeah. Under my tutelage.
I know. I'm getting more and more civilised working with Adela. And you've just come back from the far north.
From the far north of Queensland, where it was unbelievably hot and humid. And I was working with a number of services that Nightlamp provides consultancy to. And we set up some great things for children whilst I was sweating bucket loads.
And at one point, I think you told me on the phone you got stuck in Townsville and you couldn't fly back up to Cairns.
I got stuck in Townsville one afternoon. We had a training session in the morning, and as we were finishing the training, the clouds were rolling in. It was getting darker and darker and darker, and I thought Armageddon has come. And then it just exploded in the most unbelievable thunderstorm I've ever seen in my life. Obviously a tropical thunderstorm that I, having been brought up in England and lived in Melbourne, am not used to. It was nature at its best. It was an amazing, spectacular show. And as a consequence, no planes could fly out.
I'm actually relieved when a flight gets cancelled. There's part of me deep down that I feel relieved only because everyone who knows me knows I'm reasonably, not as petrified as I used to be, but I get pretty anxious on planes. And do you know that flight between Townsville and Cairns?
Mm.
I experienced some really high quality, very skilled dyadic co-regulation on that flight.
Did you? Who did that with you? The air hostess?
Yes, because I was on that tiny little propeller plane that looks like it got borrowed from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And we were flying to Cairns and it was so bumpy that I thought I was sitting there looking like the coolest guy in the world, because I thought, I've got this. My face will betray nothing of what's happening under the skin. And as I was sitting there, absolutely doubtless that I was about to plummet to my doom, I heard this little voice just behind me, this really kind voice of the flight attendant, and she said, "Oh, it's always bumpy in these bits, but then it levels out."
I'm a very good flyer. I like flying. I love taking off. I like all the whole business. I don't get anxious, strangely, because here I am in a tin can up in the sky with nothing to support me. But suspend disbelief. I fly very well. But I have a maxim, which is, you don't panic until the flight attendants look worried.
Exactly.
Right? I don't care how bumpy it is, while the flight attendants are calmly waltzing up and down the aisles, offering you things, don't worry. If they start to look phased, I worry.
And they're the perfect regulators, aren't they? Yeah. I mean, when she first said those words to me, I felt both calmed and soothed straight away. But I also felt a little bit like, I felt like saying, don't you try and co-regulate me. I know exactly what
don't
you're
you
up to.
Don't you patronise me.
But it worked. And I often say to people when we are running our workshops that the way we have to be with children who we work with, who are traumatised, is to actually think like a flight attendant. That they look at us to check if the plane's going to go down or not.
That's
and when
right.
they look at us and they
exactly.
see that we're calm and we're well
That's
and
right.
we're in control of ourselves,
That's right.
They can also become more regulated. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think there was an article that someone sent to me about a domestic flight in the States where one of the flight attendants started crying. I think she was upset about something completely unrelated to aviation safety. But apparently it sent the entire cabin into chaos and they had to do an emergency landing.
Well, I think there's a really interesting parallel there in terms of the work that we do, because yes, I agree that while it is exceptionally difficult to stay calm and regulated in the face of a child who is extremely dysregulated and perhaps being violent and chucking stuff around, it is possibly one of the most important things we can do. In that circumstance, calm presence that is quiet and doesn't seek to talk is probably the best thing that can be done. On the same principle as the flight attendant principle, where there's turbulence. If there's something to worry about, you will see it in their face.
Yep.
And as a subtle, tacit message to children, if we're calm and we're quiet, there's nothing to worry about. It's all going to be dealt with.
That's right. I mean, we can all remember times when we've been working with children or caring for children and we have a colleague who is panicking and clearly in a state of anxiety. And it also says a lot about what kind of state we need to, if we're working with children like that, what kind of state we need to turn up to work in. And how important it is that we leave our own anxieties and baggage at home in whichever way we manage to do that. That's a duty that we have.
And I guess one of the things that's worth mentioning is the fact that children that we work with are hypervigilant. So if we are in a state that we're trying to conceal, they will see it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can remember over the years consulting to a number of staff groups where people had become quite heightened about working with children themselves and would report feeling sick as the car turned into the street where the residential house was at the thought of having to deal with certain behaviours and certain presentations. And the most important thing that we can do under those circumstances is actually work with that feeling to kind of give voice to the staff to say, if you absolutely can't deal with that, don't go to work.
Yeah.
Because, in fact, it's better to deal with it before going to work than trying to hide it then and there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many. I mean, look how much we've learnt just from flight attendants.
Well, look at that.
Well, what are we going to talk about today? I guess we've already talked a lot, but one of the things that I was thinking about, Adela, is that I was approached the other day. Someone spoke to me about the role of behaviour charts in working with children who present with developmental trauma. So we're talking about, you know, extremely challenging behaviour, and they're asking me about what is the role of, you know, you know what I mean by a behaviour chart, where you have a chart with different desirable behaviours that the child then gets, and maybe a sticker, and when they accumulate so many stickers, they get some kind of material reward.
Yes.
Or a social reward, and we know, well, the research says social rewards are far more effective and long-lasting. But so what are your thoughts on behaviour charts? I mean, I have my thoughts on what I think. You know, you and I have talked about it many times.
Well, I fear that people are not going to like my thoughts on behaviour charts. And I'll preface my thoughts on behaviour charts by saying we are talking exclusively about how to work with children who have developmental trauma.
Yes.
So I want to be absolutely clear that I'm not, when I say what I'm about to say, I'm not applying it to healthy children who have not got a developmental trauma history, because I think that behaviour charts are fine for those children. But okay. In relation...
You have well and truly qualified your
thank you.
response.
But I am extremely, I suppose cautious would probably be an understatement, but I would not be recommending the use of behaviour charts for children with developmental trauma, at least until they have worked through some of their trauma at a later stage and have one solid, really well-developed relationship. That may be something that could be introduced at that stage. But in the beginning stages of working with children with developmental trauma, I don't believe that behavioural charts and reward systems work at all. In fact, I feel as if they work against the best interests of children. Because let's take apart what it is about behaviour charts that works. When you set up a behavioural agreement with a child and use a chart to support it, what you're doing when you set up a behavioural arrangement with a child is you're actually showing them something that you would like them to be able to achieve. Sure, it's in their best interests, but it is also geared and focused towards what is loosely described as acceptable behaviour in any given situation. Now, one of the big risks in doing that with a child who has developmental trauma is that you're really offering them a way of chronicling their failures rather than chronicling their successes. And one of the reasons for that is because in setting up a behaviour chart, one of the prerequisites is that the child needs to be able to achieve what you're trying to help them to achieve. They may struggle with it, but they need to have a fighting chance.
Yep, yep.
And very often with children who suffer from developmental trauma, they're not ready yet to have a fighting chance.
Well, there's an assumption there, isn't there, that with a behaviour chart, there's the assumption that the unwanted behaviour, whatever that is actually a choice. And many of the behaviours that are unwanted or inappropriate or challenging or whatever we want to call it, many of those behaviours are actually not a choice.
No.
And they come as a function of how the child's feeling on a chronic basis. Like, you know, they're chronically feeling like this and they simply don't have the ability. So they are reacting to something because they're chronically under threat or in fear.
Absolutely.
And so there's a great deal of shame that comes with the inability to change that behaviour when you simply can't, and those around you are expecting it to be a choice. And it's a little bit of, some of this stuff is what we talked about in the last podcast about violent reactions.
I suppose a couple of the things I just want to mention is that, and it kind of goes to the same reason as to why I don't think that things like any cognitive approach, mm-hmm. really, things like anger management sessions for children with developmental trauma work either. The problem is, and we talked about the arousal continuum, I think, last time a little bit, we mentioned it, but when children are up the arousal continuum, which most children with developmental trauma are actually at a fairly high level of, their baseline of functioning is well above the average baseline of functioning, and they're not calm, they're in a state of some level of arousal, both emotionally and physiologically, their capacity to think is reduced. So if you are introducing what is essentially a thought-based strategy, you're actually asking for the impossible.
Yeah.
Because whilst in a calm situation, when you're explaining to them what the chart is all about, they may be able to go, oh, okay, so if I do X when I feel X, this particular way rather than Y, I'll get a star. And if I continue to do the thing I'm not meant to do, I won't get a star. They can think about that. But when they're in the midst of the feeling and they're heightened, they're going to be unable to think. And so we know really that we're just setting them up to fail, because we're reminding them how difficult it is for them and how easy it is for them to fail, which fills them with shame, which really is a very corrosive and unhelpful state.
And the other thing which I think is often misunderstood is that even when these children are not hyper-aroused and can think, sometimes a behaviour chart can be problematic, because we're talking about children who come into the world and for whatever reason, they have not been able to internalise a dependability and reliability on parents to give them, provide protection or nurture or shelter or all those basic things that we need. So actually what we end up developing is a very negative relational template. In other words, a view of ourselves that we are unworthy of good things and that we are not worthy of success. It's a kind of intolerance to success. And so they're actually internally and in a very unconscious way looking for evidence that they can't succeed. And so nothing makes it easier for you than a chart in front of you with a diagram that shows you you have failed. You simply have to not do a certain thing and you don't receive the reward, and it's right there in front of you. And so I think we have to be very wary of that.
And I think also the tendency towards setting up behaviour chart arrangements, it's a natural tendency. If one is unable to think about the consequences of developmental trauma, if we aren't accepting that the internal landscape of children who have developmental trauma is very, very different to the internal landscape of children who have not had that experience. So it's a very basic failure to grasp the depth of need in children who have developmental trauma, and the fact that those kinds of approaches, whilst it would be absolutely wonderful if they could work, won't work. And that not only will they not work, but I guess my particular negative feeling about them is that they actually make the child somewhat worse, because they undermine what small sense of capacity they might actually have. Now, that's not to say, as I said at the start, that at some point within a safe and trusting relationship that may be developed, you could start to introduce that kind of concept, but it would have to be done extremely cautiously and very carefully, and only once you are absolutely certain that the child is ready.
There's a stage at which it can actually come in. And I think before that stage, before you can set up a visual system of rewarding desirable behaviours, you actually have to set up a system of constantly rewarding the child regardless of the behaviour, just for simply being worthy.
Random acts of kindness, I called it.
Yep.
as you would with an infant, and keeping in mind that what we're really doing when we work with children with developmental trauma of any age, whether they be 5, 10 or 16, as Bruce Perry says, they are still like an infant. They are still developmentally well behind what their chronological age is. So we have to suspend that. It's a bit like when you go to the movies and you suspend disbelief. We have to suspend our disbelief about children. Forget what chronological age they are and work with them at the functional age they are. So what do we do with a baby? What do we do with a two-year-old?
Well, we don't tell them to act like they're 14.
No. And what we do with infants is we reward the tiniest things that they do. They walk up a step. Oh, that's fantastic. We, if you like, over-reward them. But that's what we do because we're encouraging them. And so we have to with children with developmental trauma because they are little babies inside and they're taking steps to trust the world. So we have to make the world a very safe and trusting place for them. And we need to be able to suspend our knowledge of the chronological age they are and relate to them as they are inside. And on another podcast, there would be umpteen stories
That makes me think when any of us are in that state. Mm. I mean, what did I need when I was on that flight, on that bumpy flight? I actually needed someone to baby me a little bit and
That's
reassure
right.
me, like, you know, because
it's all
at that
right.
time,
it's usually bumpy here.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, when we're not well, when we get ill, we usually like our partner to bring us a hot drink. And I personally like a story.
What's your favourite story, Stefan?
Winnie the Pooh, but the original, the original.
I'm a great devotee of the Three Bears, but never mind.
No, I'm an A.A. Milne fan, and I just wish it had never been sold out to Disney. But that is an entire episode on its own.
My granddaughter loves the story of Peter Rabbit when he went out with his three sisters.
Yes.
And went where he was told not to go.
Yes, yes.
Into Mr. McGregor's garden.
My kids loved Peter Rabbit and Mr.
It's a cautionary tale.
Grumpy Mr. McGregor.
Yes. It's a cautionary tale. However, going back to the point of behavioural charts, I remember once, and I think this is really important to say, that we should be transparent with children because children who we work with may have been given these expectations before and may ask, oh, can I have a behaviour chart? And when I was managing Hurstbridge Farm, in fact, one of the boys did come to me because he wanted to achieve a particular end. He wanted a particular CD. He came to me and he said, can I have a behaviour chart so that I can collect stars and get this CD by the end of a week?
Obviously, he'd had that before.
He'd had that before. Yeah. I knew with absolute certainty from some events that had happened over preceding weeks that there was no possibility that he was going to be able to regulate himself to the point where he would get sufficient stars or any stars by the end of a week. And I was in a bit of a quandary because I thought, well, I don't want to be dishonest with this boy and I don't want to set him up to fail. So I actually opted for the transparent approach and I said, well, actually, no. I don't think I will be doing that for you. He said, oh, why not? And I said, well, because I've been looking at some of the things that you've been struggling with over the past couple of weeks, and I honestly don't think that you'll be able to get what you want by the end of the week. And I don't actually believe in setting kids up to fail. I think there will come a time when you'll be able to do it, but that time hasn't come now. So what can we do to get you from this time to that time? Mm-hmm. And are there some other ways that you can earn the money or get together somehow, some way of buying the CD? Mm-hmm. So I didn't leave him completely without any options. Mm. But I made it very clear to him that I didn't like setting kids up to fail. There would be a time when I thought he would be able to do it, but now wasn't it.
But that also, you also gave him the hope and the knowledge absolutely. That actually you believe he's getting better and that he will get better.
Yeah, absolutely. But that he wasn't there yet.
Yeah.
And my worry was that two things would have
happened. That's different to saying you can't do it.
Oh, you can't do it. Absolutely. Yeah. Two things happened in there. There were two really important messages. One was a realistic appraisal of where he was at now and being honest about that, but in a very calm and benign way, because as I've just described it to you is exactly how I said it to him. And the other is the message of hope and work that can be done to get children to that point, all of which is very important to incorporate, but all of which is very important to say in a very benign way, in keeping with pace. And we were talking about this a little bit earlier on, because when children are chronically heightened, they are very quick to jump to conclusions. Yeah. And when children are chronically used to failing, they're very quick to jump to conclusions because they're in a heightened state already. So one has to be able to be very neutral and benign in how one says things so that the child can hear the content rather than get caught up and in a way waylaid by emotion. Because they will pick up on the emotion because they're hypervigilant. So very important to say it neutrally, very important to say it clearly, and very important to give hope. Lots of things to hold on to at one time. So I guess I think no wonder sometimes people find it very complicated and complex work, because it is. It's extremely difficult.
You bet. Mm. But it is possible.
It is absolutely
possible.
Yes, it is absolutely possible.
And we've seen, I mean, we keep seeing examples of it, and we keep seeing kids get better, and we know it can be done. And I guess it can be done without behaviour charts, at least at the beginning.
It can be done without behaviour charts. But again, very important to say, not knocking behaviour charts in and of themselves. Mm. For healthy children who have good attachments, who aren't riddled with shame and a sense that they can't actually do anything of worth, they're fine. Mm. They set expectations. Those well-functioning relationships will assist them to achieve them. All children struggle with things at times. Children with developmental trauma struggle pretty much all of the time in their relationships, but even healthy children will struggle. It's just that the struggles may look the same, but they come from two very different sets of reasons.
Well, there you go. We've spent, I think, a good solid episode on behaviour charts.
We have.
we've had some requests from some of our friends on Facebook for, you know, some things for us to discuss
topics.
Certain themes and topics. And so we promise we most definitely will be touching on all those in the coming weeks.
Very good.
But this has been another enjoyable chat, and with a lovely cup of tea with little lumps of sugar.
Yes, and I hope that people will feel free and interested to contribute thoughts or questions or even disagreement.
Absolutely. Feel free to give us feedback, to argue, and to ask any questions or, you know, or provide any ideas for topics.
See you, or hear you, or you will hear us on another occasion very soon.
Okay. Thanks. See ya.
Bye-bye.